of another day. Our seventh evening together. I'm sure the perception is arising, not only the ending of a day, the perception of nearing the ending of this retreat. Encouraging us to use this time well to listen into ending. The non-comprehension of ending. The non-understanding of things becoming otherwise, things changing, arising and passing. And we don't really know that, not just intellectually, but when we can't bear that on some level, when we consciously or unconsciously prefer birth, interest, the next new thing, the next thing, there's enthusiasm, there's energy in that. But then the price one pays is never arriving. Not knowing anything in completion, not really knowing the cycle, not really comprehending the fading, the dying, and recognizing the vastness and the space which it's all happening in. It's, nothing could happen without that context, without that ground. And yet when we imagine the ground to be the forms, the emotions, the circumstances, the excitement, we've been studying together, we take birth on that which is by its nature, through no fault of its own, by its nature, it's becoming otherwise every instant. So when we climb onto that, identify with that, take birth in that, there's the continual sense of instability which needs to be guarded and protected and struggled with, and all the stresses and fears and conflict emerge. From not deeply and really understanding that what arises passes. The first disciple who understood what the Buddha taught, who understood not just with the ear, not just the principle, everything changes, if you grasp it, what changes, yeah, there's going to be a bit of stress there. That's a start. But who practiced and then deeply recognized that. His name was Kundanya, one of the first five ascetics, who was with the Buddha in this early struggle for awakening. And he was, with four others, abandoned the Buddha to be when they thought he went soft when he started eating. And, you know, the real scandal was he didn't only start eating, but he accepted food from a beautiful young maiden, I mean, which was... that's bad enough. And not only that, it was milk rice, which is basically like ice cream, you know. So they, but then when the Buddha was awakened and was considering who to share this with, his earlier teachers who had taught him those subtle states, he thought that they'll understand, but they had already died. And they were already in such a subtle, timeless, peaceful, heavenly realm that would last for a long time, they weren't available. And so then he thought, who would understand? He's all the five previous ascetics. So he went out and walked by stages, took a few weeks. It's quite some distance from Bodh Gaya to Sarnath, to Benares. And then when they saw him coming, and then they said to each other, the five ascetics, "Hey, look, slackers. We'll be polite, but we won't make a special seat for him. You know, we're not going to do any special respect for things. Because after all, eating and the girl." But as he got closer, he was so radiant, they couldn't help but greet him. But then when he started to say, "Hey, look, listen, I've found it." Yeah. They wouldn't believe him. And then he said, "Have I talked this way before? Have you ever heard me talk this way?" He said, "No." And then he talked the four ennobling truths, that first turning of the wheel of the law, about dukkha and its cause and its cessation in the past. And at the end of that discourse, he uttered, and Kundanyo knows. One of the disciples really got it. Kundanyo knows. So he called him Anya Kundanya. I think it's the one who knows. His eye of Dhamma has opened. He had touched Nibbana. He had entered the stream. And what I'm getting to is, you know how he summed up Kundanyo's insight? The Buddha said, "What Kundanya knows is that what arises ceases." And to deeply know that whatever arises ceases, whatever begins ends, starts finishes. To deeply recognize that in breath, in sensation, in thought, in form, in circumstance, when we've through sustained presence, recognize that, then it's obvious. Demanding the world of change to give us lasting satisfaction is like asking, as Ajahn Chah would say, it's like asking a duck why it's not a chicken. Or it's like boxing a tree. It's exhausting and futile, because, or it's like arguing with a river, why are you flowing that way? It's its nature to flow that way. It's the nature of what arises to cease. And when Kundanyo saw that what arises ceases, there was the basic giving back what wasn't his. He had claimed something that wasn't his. He'd occupied and claimed something that wasn't his. Gave back to Dhamma, to nature. And in that relinquishment, not grasping, not rejecting, it's a patinisagaya, a relinquishing, a letting go, a giving back. The eye of Dhamma opened, and he noticed that which never dies. He saw the Dhamma. And when you see the Dhamma, you see the Buddha. He knew the Buddha. He knew then the awakened one. Even the Buddha's form. Conventionally, okay, he was called the Buddha. Because of all his good karma and his radiant mind, he glowed, and his features were beautiful. So it said. One of the young disciples just liked sitting and gazing at the Buddha. Because, I mean, golden skin and radiant aura and beautiful features and eloquent and mindful, just gazed at the Buddha. And the Buddha inside thought, I'm not sure he knows what the Buddha is. And so he sent him off to a branch monastery, so to speak, sent him off to practice somewhere in the distance. Ajahn Chah, our teacher, would do that too. And then the disciples lamenting, "I've been sent away from the Buddha, separate from the Buddha." what have I done wrong? Cut off from the Buddha. And it said in this particular account of the Buddha's teachings, it said that the Buddha appeared before him. He said, what are you lamenting about? Well, Lord, you sent me away. And that the Buddha pointed to his body and said, you think this is the Buddha? Mm-hmm. What arises ceases. This body is going back to the earth, to the elements. The air goes back to the air, the water to the water, the earth to the earth, the fire to the fire element. He said, he who sees the Dhamma, the person who sees the Dhamma, who sees the way of things, sees the Buddha. And the Buddha sees the Dhamma, sees the way of things. So Kandanya saw that what arises ceases. So let's not underestimate the significance of really knowing this. So this last little bit of this retreat, we have an opportunity to listen into that. Soon enough, believe me, we're going to have plenty of conversation, plenty of activity, plenty of... And it's wonderful to be with Sangha and to have the chance to interact. But I really encourage us, to each of us, to the best of our ability, to use this last little bit to just contemplate what endings is like for us. Whether we don't find it hard endings. How much of our heart's already in the next thing. Not to judge ourselves, but to get to know that. To really make the effort to see a cycle through. That's why it's so important to be with the in-breath and the out-breath. To get a sense of that is the nature to begin and end. And what we call the retreat, which seems so solid, will disperse without a trace. Where did everybody go? It's been a privilege and a wonderful experience. It's always a privilege to practice the Dhamma, and so for Tanisha and myself, it's a privilege and a responsibility to share that to the best of our ability. We're still practicing. We have a lot to still learn. We make mistakes, plenty. And forgive us for what seems wrong or what's not quite right. But as Tanisha said the other day, reflect on what is useful. In the end, the important thing is each of us continuing the investigation into the way things are. I feel very, very, very fortunate that we've had teachers like we've had many, many teachers. Ajahn Chah, our main teacher in our monastic life, and then his senior Western disciple, Ajahn Sumedho. And then our fellow monks and nuns. And the great Chinese master, Master Hua, who taught us about the Bodhisattva heart, about serving, and about the Kuan Yin Dharmas. But, I feel very grateful to have had the chance to encounter the Buddhist teachings, and more as the disenchantment of the practice. Excuse me, I say that positively. You know, at first, in my naive enthusiasm, as I told y'all the other night, I just wanted it to happen quickly. And now, being disillusioned, letting that illusion go, disenchanted, letting that enchantment go, this is a tough path. Arduous. The alternative is not so good, though. Not practicing and then just bumping into life, getting knocked over all the time, not really having a way of contemplating the karma, contemplating what leads to stress, contemplating peace, being unconscious, it's not so good. And yet this practice, as we go deeper into ourselves, we face these challenges and these patterns, which are difficult. But when we just take it one moment at a time, it's doable and it's possible. So basically, we encourage everyone to continue and to review on this aspects that we've been touching on, and to review a more overview of the Buddhist teachings. Sometimes when the Buddha was asked, what do you teach? He made it really simple. I teach suffering and non-suffering. It's not just dukkha and the ending of dukkha. Sometimes when he was asked to elaborate a little more, he would say, well, this teaching is about impeccable living, living in a way that doesn't cause harm to ourselves and others, what's called restraint, sila, which is a foundation then for samadhi, what we've been practicing, the stabilizing of heart, the unification of body-mind, the recognition that there's a possibility of ease and gatheredness and brightness welling up from within. What's called the middle of the path, sila, restraint in activity, body and speech, samadhi, gatheredness, and punya, or wisdom, seeing into the nature of things, being freed from delusion, freeing the heart from birth and death through this letting go and tasting and touching and little by little abiding in the deathless. That was another way that the Buddha did an overview of his teaching. Another way that he often did was one that I'll touch on this evening. Another way that he elaborated a little more on this path of from suffering to the ending of suffering was a formulation called Dana Sila Bhavana. I believe you heard something about Dana today, and we're practicing this essential virtue today, Dana, generosity. And which in the perfections, the balamita, the word the Buddha used was balamita, that which carries us to the goal. The Buddha talked about 10 virtues that carry us to this goal of freedom. Don't worry, I'm not going to go through all 10 tonight. But I'm not. But Dana's the first one. Because the essential aspect of dukkha is the opposite of dana, is grasping. Mine, me, mine. And as someone said, putting our flag on that. Which is not that that's an evil activity, it's fair enough to have that tendency. But as we've been reflecting, when we do that, what we put our flag on, what we identify with, if it's shaky, that's a problem. There's a sense of instability and death, and then having to reestablish, regrasp. Grasping, well, Donna is the opposite of that. Actually, things are shifting and flowing all the time. There's all sorts of interdependent flows. We know in terms of receiving breath, giving out the CO2, the trees, the shrubs, you know, breathe out oxygen, we breathe in the oxygen. That's just one cycle. So the Buddha often started with Dana. Westerners tend to be more interested in the meditation as a starting point. We've had enough. Some of us have been brought up with all these religious shoulds. You should be this way, you should be patient, and you should do this, and don't do that, or else you're going to be in big trouble. And so we've tended to react. Many of us have bruising from our religious education. Where sometimes the meditation, the encouragement to see for ourselves, having permission to doubt, to inquire, to use the instrument of awareness to make contact with the nature of things. That's been very appealing. And so it's been the beginning, very important beginning of the path. But if we're practicing, you'll probably notice, when you're practicing meditation, if you're even subtly going in there and trying to get something, we've had a taste, and then we want that again. So we're meditating to get peaceful. We're meditating to get sometimes an insight. We're meditating to get enlightened. We're meditating to get rid of. Or meditating to get out of. Sometimes the grasping element, what we've called desire, deluded desire, is unconscious. And sometimes this contemplation of generosity can really help. Just like this morning when we looked at kindness, sometimes this aversion, hadn't been conscious of it, but if we start by accepting, welcoming, allowing, we find ourselves more easily here. In a sense, this kindness, all these virtues blend with each other, is a sort of offering. We're offering space to things. Okay, you're allowed to do that. Seeing the perfection, we're offering and allowing. It's a sort of offering. Have you ever tried to sit down and meditate and make that an offering, to our, this body, some peace, offer just an opportunity to pause. Breathing in and offering an out-breath as a gentle wave, as a gentle offering to the world, a gentle wave of not harming, that's an offering. It's a religious right in a ritual, but it can be deeper than that. Sometimes with our shrine, our symbols, they're just symbols. With our shrine at home, I'll take an incense stick and light it, and I'm offering a burning point of light that sends fragrance in all directions, permeating all space. I offer this incense in the heart to the awakened one, for the welfare of all beings. So for the moment when we make an offering, the mind is connected. It's more spacious. The grasping mind's very limited, very shaky, very stressful. There's all sorts of ways to explore offering in our lives. Even our work. It's different if we make it an offering, just an offering. Even someone who's unemployed, someone says, oh, gosh, I don't remember someone coming to me really struggling with that, and that's a really difficult thing. In this particular case, it wasn't so much the financial problem, but just feeling useless. What can I do? We should even remember, encourage them, just be a mecca sweeper. Just offer that. Just walk around. Walk around on the streets. Walk around, breathing in and offering a moment of letting your eyes just touch buildings, touch beings, touch people with a sense of allowing. That gentle gift of a presence that's offering. The Buddha taught that this has tremendous capacity to bring joy when we're sharing energy flowing through it. And this can overturn many states of disconnection, many states of struggle. I have a memory that came back today of when I was a monk in the monastery. I spent a few years, many years sick, but a few years really sick. So I spent most of those few years lying down, doing the lying down meditation. Because I had internal bleeding, I had chronic inflammation, I couldn't digest anything, I'd gotten over typhoid and it left all this sort of damage inside. And so I couldn't go to meetings and things in the monastery. One day, though, I looked out the window. I was put up in the attic and of this house in our monastery in England. And I saw one of the visitors to the monastery. It was a cold, sort of damp day, winter day. I saw him, no one else was out there, walking down the drive with a rope. And I thought, gee, is he going to kill himself? And it's like, you know, you see something like that. You know. So even though I wasn't feeling very good, I quickly just put a robe on, but I didn't have much, and I went and followed him into the forest, and he was trying to hang himself. And he had been in prison for, I think, rape and attempted rape and different things. He was a very, very tormented soul. And he was determined to hang himself. And his mind had inverted. It was in this space, just a dark space. So he had this rope. It was in a noose, and he was, you know, trying to do it on a tree. And anyway, I was trying to talk him out of it. It was cold, so my teeth started chattering. They were, you know, have you heard these woodpeckers in the morning? I love woodpeckers because we have them back in America, but I haven't been hearing them in Africa, so it's been lovely to hear the woodpeckers again here. But anyway, that's what my teeth were doing. And suddenly he notices that my teeth are chattering. And it's like he snaps out of it. You're cold. And he gave me his leather jacket. A gift, a Donna gift. Gave me his leather jacket. And he snapped out of it just like a whoosh. Now, not permanently, but you know, it had a big impact. Big impact on the state that was just so me, self, despair, this. Notice how Donna, when we make a gift, we're opening, we're connecting. Very important principle. Our true nature is more open, is more vast. The false nature is this identifying with some mood, some thought, some form, some condition. It's toxic in there. It's not aerating. It's not breathing. The Buddha gave very special teachings about this cultivating spacious state. Call it the simile of the salt crystal. What is it that's assailing us? What is it that takes us into this place? Well, he was getting drawn into this. It was like a whirlpool dragging him down. What's going on when we get locked into depression, locked into agitation, locked into desire, locked into rage, locked into the things? That's called karma vipaka. It's resultant karma sweeping us. And some present karma too. It's believing it and following it and choosing it. But there's also many, oftentimes it's these patterns that these dongas, these channels for the water to flow down the mountain, these psychological channels that the energy just has habitually gone through. Are we just a slave to that stuff? And so the Buddha once said about this karma, he said if every time we did something, if how we made a karma happen, karma means creation, if we had to receive the result in the way that we did it, he said there would be no escape. In other words, if I go and harm an animal, you know, like in Africa, Smith was talking about how, you know, people are afraid of frogs and things like that. If I, you know, or snakes, people are terrified of snakes. In part of the rural area where we are, when people find snakes, they kill them. they think we're nuts that we catch these poisonous snakes and take them down the road in a place where no one's living. But if you kill a snake, does that mean then you have to become a snake and get killed by someone? If you punch someone, does that mean the law of karma means you have to be hit back? Is it rigid like that? The Buddha said if that was the case, if for everything we did, it had to happen just the other way, there would be no escape. We've all done so many things. No way out. But he said if you reformulated it, that the way you make karma to be felt, then some result has to be felt like that. So harming a snake is painful. Is there some pain that comes back? And he said, yes, there's an escape. And he gave this example in this teaching of two people that did the same thing. Some trifling deed that's unwholesome. And I was trying to think up one, and I thought, well, in Africa, sometimes when you're driving, it's easy to get quite agitated because people have all kinds of their own rules about driving. and somebody does something outrageous, and these black taxis are famous for just owning the road. They have crammed people in there and coming in front. And occasionally one can say, that's outrageous, and kind of snarl or even beep. You think I'm crazy here? I was everybody. Anyway, that's dangerous in Africa. Well, maybe it's here too, but I mean that's dangerous because over there, you know, someone can pull off the road and then take the gun out, beep at me, and you know. So why is it that one person gets upset about someone else driving, and the next thing they know, they've been run off the road and shot. Drug into a painful state against their will. Whereas another person immediately still gets mad, maybe, I said trifling, beeps the horn or something like that, but then suddenly thinks, wait a minute, and you see the guy's face turn angry, and you just say, wait a minute, just slow down, don't worry. And immediately you think, you know, it's not that skillful to get upset when you're driving. Just go on. And, you know, the incident passes. Why is it the two people do a similar thing? One has this really heavy, one has another. And the Buddha gave this example. He said, in one case, if a person's undeveloped, it's just an analogy, but if a person's undeveloped in developing spacious states, in developing mindfulness of body, in developing virtue, in developing generosity, in developing wisdom, if they're living in contracted places, when that kind of person even does something a little more, an unskillful thing, can take them to a painful place. Whereas someone who has developed more spacious states, cultivating wisdom, presence of heart, mindfulness, unlimited states, that sometimes when they do an unskillful thing, immediately the result comes. Immediately they feel, it wasn't so good. But it doesn't last long. And the image the Buddha gave was a salt crystal. He said if you had a small cup of water and a lump of salt in there, trying to drink it, it's hard to drink. It's bitter. Whereas if you take that same lump of salt and drop it in a fresh flowing river that's pure, he said to the monks, can you drink that? Because it's dissolved. We can then drink that. Our karma is flexible. It's dissolvable. Most karmas are dissolvable. This young man who was trying to take his life, when he was in a very contracted state, no connection with anything, contracted state. He couldn't drink that. It was sweeping him against his will. Then he made a gesture of giving, connecting. for that moment, that helped dissolve that stuff. Dhamma's very important for creating spaciousness, so that it's easier to have the space, the energy to see things well up and go. Similar with virtue, the formulation of the path that the Buddha gave, generosity, and then impeccable restraint, living by the precepts, living where you're trying not to harm, not to take what doesn't belong, not to exploit your own or someone else's sexuality, to try to use speech for truthfulness and communication and harmony, to honor consciousness, not just to seek freedom by just intoxication, but to seek freedom through understanding, to honor the instrument of consciousness. These restraints, they seem limited, but notice that they actually create a web. It creates a bigger field. When we train ourselves to try not to harm, then in a sense we're making a gift to other beings so that they can breathe more easily. When we train ourselves not to take that which is not given, we're acknowledging our relationship with each other, acknowledging the trust that's so significant in us living together in harmony. So those who cultivate virtue, we realize our relationship in this fabric. The person who doesn't have that, what world do they live in? They don't care what effect it has on you. It's what I want that's important. You're in my way. You're gone. You know. You want that? I'm there first. You know. Truthfulness? So what? Telling a lie? I want that. So truth just does anything you want to get what one wants. That world is a very little world. The world where there's no restraint is the world of me and what I want and what I don't want. Or maybe it includes some of my friends. Still very limited. But even my friends, if I'm willing to lie and do anything, then you start thinking, not sure who you can really trust. You're not even sure yourself anymore. We can become such experts at lying, experts at denial, that we don't know anymore. But that's just little. So when we're, our world is not really connected, that's this small cup where the karmas that we do have more potency to sweep us against our will. This is why in our samadhi practice, the Buddha encouraged, yes, presence of mind, but notice he encouraged the whole body so that we can dissolve some of these toxicities. Sometimes when a mood is so strong, it carries us away, but when we start to feel it in the body and help the body hold it, it's easier to stay with it, easier to work with it, easier to breathe into it. So in samadhi we learn to be with, in metta practice we learn to expand and be with, so that what we used to call self we realize is shifting and changing and depending on other factors. So these spaciousness practices start to open us up. I'm going to getting into bhavana, the last part. Dana, generosity, sila, restraint. Bhavana is the word the Buddha used for cultivation, like a garden. And bhavana includes the samadhi practices, the stability practices, the metta practices, the wisdom practices. All that's considered bhavana. Samatha vipassana is bhavana. It's a cultivation. It's a very helpful image. It's not instant. It's often compared to a garden. If we plant something in the garden, we can make it grow. We can see that there's water. We can see that there's good soil. We can see that there's protection. We can work on removing weeds, but we can't make it grow. When it starts, many of you probably heard the Chinese story, the farmer, the shoots had come up, and they were just starting to come through the ground, and the old farmer came home and announced to his children, "I've just discovered a new principle." You know those shoots that were coming up in our rice fields? They're now 2 inches tall. Because he had gone out and just, he was helping them. He had lifted each one up. And the kids were saying, "Are you sure?" He says, "Not scientifically proven method. Look out there." And he lifted it all up. He'd worked for hours. All up like that. And so the kids said, "Okay, Dad." So they went out and looked, and of course they'd all had shriveled. And in our practice, we get impatient. We're not growing fast enough. We can cultivate. But as the Buddha said, "Maga hatakilesa wa patanupati dhammatam." Maga means the path, this activity of awareness. Hatakilesa wa. Hata means breaks up the affliction. The path, awareness, reveals the clinging, reveals the aversion. But the patanupati dhammatang, the goal, the peacefulness, the fruits, upati, arise nu dhammatang. It arises according to its own laws. We can't make that happen. We can't find patience. We can't force it. We can offer awareness. Offer the practices, and then allow the garden to grow in its own time. And the practices that help, these spaces practices that help dissolve the salt, lumps of salt, dissolve the obstructions, or just what we've been practicing moments of mindfulness, practicing moments of offering, practicing moments of kindness, practicing moments of investigation and understanding, practicing moments of letting go. Another really helpful, we haven't said a lot about it, but it's very, very important in our life in Africa, in our life as lay people, and it definitely works with this principle of offsetting the cramped spaces that we get into when we're enchanted with the self, with me. And that's this chanting, or what's called puja, or praising. And doesn't have to be done with the hands like this, but I remember I said this links me between the inner and the outer. The inner sometimes is this sense of me being contracted and struggling, and when I remember the qualities of the Buddha, the refuge, the Buddha is limitless wisdom, limitless knowing things the way they are. So for a moment, in the awareness is the sense of contracted self, but also linking with, opening to that which we cherish, the limitless awareness, with Buddha, with Dhamma, the way things are, with Sangha, practice, and those practitioners, those fellow beings that we respect and learn from. Did any of you notice that occasionally we would do a mantra and your state of mind would be different after it than before? Did you notice that sometimes? It is for me many times. That's just this salt crystal effect. It's just this effect of the young visitor to the monastery who was locked into this state that was taking him to his own suicide, and just made a gesture of offering, and it shifted it. In a way, pujaca pujaniyanam, learning to honor what is worthy of honor, for a moment links us to something wider and gives us a new perspective. It can be a very helpful practice. Just remembering Sangha, beings that we respect, remembering the Dhamma, the teachings, the way things are, remembering the refuge of Buddha, using a phrase, using a mantra. One of my favorite ones is Namo Kwan Chi Impasa, homage to the one who listens to the sounds of the world, an awakened being who has gone beyond separateness and is just this presence of listening, of compassion. Where do we meet that? When I say Namo Kwan Chi Impasa, I return my life to the one who listens. Whatever state I'm in, I'm still in whatever state, confused or whatever. Namo, for a moment then, I return my life to the heart, to the knowing, to the listening, to the Buddha. I'm touching something that's more limitless, more spacious, that still can be in touch with the mood, with the form, but there's more space then, more energy then is available to work with that. That's been very helpful to me and to us, that you might continue to explore in irrigating this practice into one's daily life. Y'all have been very patient with all our talks. Well, I'll finish with Tanisha's encouraging me to tell one last story. The other night I told you about when I was depressed and in my locked-in state, and thank goodness I had the sense of going to meet Sangha, going to meet my teacher Ajahn Chah, and that connection helped shift it. Remember, I told him I would never laugh again, and he had me rolling on the floor. He told this story about the chipmunk. What I didn't tell you is that he told another story right after that, and I sort of conveniently blocked that out of memory for a long time. But now that story is coming back more, and I'm contemplating it more. So he told the chipmunk story, and I was really glowing in that, because remember the last bit was, and then one day the chipmunk could do everything that its mother could do. It was really skilled, and you know, that's a good ending. I'm American, I love I love Hollywood endings. And we all live happily ever after. And then he just launched right into another one and said, you know, you also remind me of a donkey. And he said, this particular donkey was it was chalat, to use the word in Thai. Chalat means it was clever, a clever donkey. This donkey was listening to in the forest of Thailand, there's a chorus of deafening, actually, the song. The insects that, I don't know what they were called, but they create this like music, you know. And this donkey, being chalat, being wise, clever, heard this and thought, I'd like to make music. And so, you know, being clever, did some investigation, and it went out and decided to investigate these crickets, these insects. And he noticed that the crickets were feeding on dewdrops. And after his vipassana, after his investigation of the situation, this donkey went around licking dewdrops. Mm-hmm. Hundreds of them. Thousands of them. Then at a certain point, he was convinced that it had enough. And so it prepared to make music. And he opened his mouth. And you know what happened. And I'm waiting for the rest of the story. And the rest of the story, and there's no more. And that was it. That was the end of the story. And I just thought, what was that about? And just little by little, I'm contemplating. And, you know, I think teachers are important. And that chipmunk, you know, teachers are important in practicing and learning and are really important. But to me, this second one, this donkey, there's something in there for all of us about, at some point, it's not about trying to make ourselves into somebody else. It's not about trying to be somebody else. Yes, there's study. Yes, there's something we work on. But at some point, it's about also learning to honor this body, honor this nervous system, honor this being. And learn to make our own sound. Learn to work with our own sound. Learn to honor that. And it doesn't mean there won't be changes and there won't be developments. But more and more in retrospect, I realize there's so much self-aversion in our culture. So much self-judgment. So much, you know, that I'm more and more fond of this donkey. So, may we all continue to practice, but may we all trust that little by little we're also relaxing into our true nature and allowing each of our unique genes, our unique nervous system, our unique heritage, our unique gift, letting that little by little expressing itself in the way that is just right for us. And I feel that makes an incredible symphony when beings are not just all trying to be the same, but when we're listening into our part to play, listening into our and sounding our sound. So on this last evening of our retreat, I offer this for us to contemplate. And good night.
Mm-hmm. Okay.